Welcome to Meridians.
Hello everyone, I'm Charlie Noble and this is Meridians. I'm trying something a little different today. I don't know why, just because I generally have notes in front of me and I read off of the notes and basically just kind of you know, pretty much word for word. Every once in a while I might riff, but I've basically gone straight from the notes. Today I'm going to try something a little different. I'm going to use my notes, but I'm just going to kind of reference them as I go along. I feel like I understand this. I understand this well enough. I mean, most people actually understand what I'm talking about today, but I'm just going to get into the details and kind of get into the mindset of the people involved, because that's really all I can do here, maybe, is to add to people's existing conception of what slavers were like. You know, I think we all kind of know how awful it is, right? It's bad. We know it's bad. But to understand how somebody could do that to somebody else, or the mindset that they're in when they did that, and their justification. So that's kind of where we're going today. So this Royal African Company, they started out as the Company of Royal Adventurers Trading into Africa. And eventually that name was changed. I think it was a few years later. But the original charter was granted to them on the 18th of December, 1660. And it was given a monopoly over English trade along the west coast of Africa with the principal objective of being the search for gold. And you could imagine that this is a part of King Charles II's reinvigoration of the monarchy. He just got control back a few years ago after having been in exile in France while Oliver Cromwell ran things in England until he died and the monarchy was actually invited back. So this Royal African Trade Company, it's run by his brother, actually, by James II. And we heard a little bit about him in the previous couple episodes, actually, because he does become king at some point, spoiler alert. But he also, New York is sort of named after him. I think it's kind of funny to say that James II is the Duke of York. Therefore, we're going to change New Amsterdam to New York. And somehow that's naming it after him. But it's like, well, it's just named after York, isn't it? Like, he's the Duke of York. I mean, I guess it's kind of a titles thing, because a lot of last names and titles take their names from actual locations, like the Habsburgs take their name from Habsburg Castle, for instance. But anyway, so James II is in charge of this Royal African Company. And their objective is originally it's to search for gold, but it changed quickly. These high-minded Christians, they'd see an even more lucrative opportunity in the region. Humans, living, breathing humans, people with families living their lives as they had, as long as they can remember. But these people that they came across, they were so much different than the British. And they had this distinction that the British and, you know, religious, this is nothing new to justify mistreating people. You just have to look down on them for their beliefs. Even if they had no concept of, no opportunity to become a Christian or a Catholic, they would still be looked down upon. And it's obviously just a moral justification. But back in the 15th century, the papacy, the Pope, had declared that enslaving infidels was permissible. In other words, if you weren't Catholic or Christian, or just didn't practice in the way the church deemed acceptable, you were an infidel. And enslaving you was not a sin. It was morally acceptable by the Vatican. Remember, at the time, Britain's official religion was the Anglican Church, which is I'd call it a spin-off of Catholicism, but I mean, it's, yeah, obviously it's not the same as that, but the Stuart family, which actually was running England at the time, Charles II, they were very much Catholic in secret. The RAC, of course, was ran by James II, the Duke of York, who was very Catholic in secret. And he was, so these Catholic values are going to weigh on them. Who knows if they specifically cited this papacy declaration? You know, somebody might have, it might have just been the vibe at the time that, like, oh, yes, we all understand that the church accepts this. But really, it is more complicated than that, because in the 15th century, the papacy might have said that enslaving infidels was permissible. But it's one of those things like, well, yeah, they say a lot of things. And over the years before and even after, the church had said the opposite, that enslaving people was not okay. There were specific references to, like, enslaving people on the Canary Islands. The Pope did not believe that was acceptable. But it's interesting how this sort of doesn't really come into play that much in the 1660s to the 1680s, when these brothers are still technically Anglican, so they don't answer to the Pope, you know? So it's kind of interesting in that way. And it won't matter afterwards, because then the Church of England would become very much established as the Church of England, and the Catholics would be out for good. But anyway, this moral justification for slavery, it's not just some declaration by the Pope. They had their own legal declarations as well. But it would be later on, after the 1660s. In 1677, there was actually a legal ruling in England to reinforce slavery as a moral practice. The case was Butts versus Penny. The court ruled that as a result of the case, black people could be considered property or goods for the purpose of trade. This decision was based on this rationale that infidels, non-Christians, could not be subjects because they could not swear an oath of allegiance. So if you can't swear an oath of allegiance because you're a non-Christian, and as a result of that, it was deemed that black people were chattels, or movable property. Chattel, I think, could be the right way to say that. I'm disgusted as you are right now. It's pretty gross to even think that this was debated in a courtroom. But this is why history matters and why it should be studied. It helps us understand the present a little better, you know? Understand what we were like before and understand our immoral history. Maybe we can learn from it, watch out for signs, and, maybe just aim for a better outcome for our future. So these English and later Europe in general, really, I mean, it really wasn't later. They would claim to be racially superior. Europeans, I don't know where they got that in their head. It's, tied to all of their advancements in technology and the way they lived their lives. It happened to be more technologically advanced, quote unquote. I say quote unquote because I debate that in my head these days as to, like, having more advanced, like, mechanical technology, more efficient. Sometimes we treat technologically advanced, that's basically another way of saying a good way for a culture that can get rich easier, is, I kind of think, a really simplified way of saying technologically advanced. I know it's kind of a weird way of looking at that, but I just think it's so arrogant to dismiss one culture over another and saying that you're more technologically advanced just because you're better at gathering resources. I mean, I guess it depends. It's all semantics, right? It's what the words actually mean. I'm sure somebody bring up Webster's Dictionary in front of me and they go, well, this is what it means. And I go, oh, yeah, I guess hopefully I've made my point that maybe you could be technologically advanced, I guess, but you're not saying you're more advanced in general. I have beef with that, one culture over another, because how do you measure what does advanced mean, right? But anyway, so Europeans claimed to be racially superior. Surprise, surprise. Then, of course, there was already slavery happening in Africa at the time between these tribes. So basically, they showed up and it's like, well, here, we've got stuff to sell you, Africans. We've got stuff to sell you. What do you guys have to trade? And they're like, well, you know, we've got the gold and we want the ivory and we want the silver, but we'll sell you these. We'll sell you some people. And then, you know, the British are like, well, sure, I'll take some people. No second thought. I'll take some of those, some of those. Oh, yeah, some people as well. I'll take that ivory there. You know, it was just doing business, you know. And so that's it's as simple as that, really. But what makes this so disturbing, this type of slavery, is that it's this indefinite ownership and generational slavery that the Europeans really made a name for themselves doing. For example, like, slaves in Egypt were generally not treated as commodities. They weren't treated as property. They simply had fewer rights. Think of them more as, like, almost more like a prisoner. And you might be like, well, what's the difference between a prisoner and a slave? Well, a lot of these so-called slaves, because it's, I mean, there's maybe it's a tiered system with, like, having fewer rights. At what point does it cross over from being like, well, I live in a dictatorship, am I a slave? At what point are you a slave, right? So it's not just some, like, boom, you're a slave. It's a loss of rights to some degree. If you have some freedom of movement, if you have some agency over your life, then I guess you're not entirely a slave. But so that's the idea. And a lot of times slavery wasn't for life, you know. A lot of time in conquest, maybe it was, or maybe you were enslaved for several years. That's a big one, is slavery of conquest. So that would be the bummer. That'd be the second worst. You know, the least worst would probably be that Egyptian type of slave, where it's kind of like you're kind of an indentured servant. It's like you don't have very many rights. It's still slavery. Let's be fair. It is still slavery, but it's not quite as cruel as some other kinds of slavery, where, yeah, you're a slave, but also all of your children will be slaves, and all of your children's children will be slaves. I mean, you're treated like cattle. You know, it's funny they say chattel, but it sounds like it might as well be cattle, as awful as that sounds. But that's the way they're treating them, and it's this dehumanization, and this generational slavery thing is not that common. It was quite unique, and it really sucks that the beginning of the United States was kind of built on slavery. And yeah, you know, but heck, if you're a Christian at the time, you just said five Hail Marys, pray to Jesus about it, and go about your business, you know. But that's what we're dealing with here. European Christians sponsored generational slavery. And it's funny because they call this time the Enlightenment. And I get really confused by this because it's like, yeah, it's sure there's this technological advancement on one side, but this moral, just completely morally bankrupt actions happening based on religion. And the Enlightenment, to me, from what I've derived from it, it's almost like the weaponization of Christianity to serve people for the sake of people, and not just serving your leader or some monarch. That's the interesting thing about all this, is that, you know, not from a democratic society where I have all the rights I can imagine, basically, for now. So I'm comparing slavery to myself and the way I live. But, you know, you go back 400 years, some peasant in France, his life isn't that much better than a slave. I mean, it's better because he probably does have a little more choice in his life, has more freedom of movement. But it's not apples to apples comparison. Like, them compared to a slave is different than a person in modern day first world country compared to a slave, I suppose. But anyway, let's not get bogged down on how bad slavery. We know it's bad, so I'll move on. So we can kind of understand that these Royal African Company, this Royal African Company, they're just, you know, that's this where the stiff upper lip, the snobby British like whole concept. I mean, it's really to come in and just buy people. You have to have a certain perspective, and they had a very specific perspective to be able to do this with a smile on their face and be okay with it. And certainly a lot of people were not okay with it back in England. Many people were not okay with it the entire time. And it's just a matter of, well, were the people loud enough? And really, was there enough business interest to keep this going? Is what it is. Was this acceptable? Yes? Okay. Then we'll do it because it makes somebody money. And that is basically the only moral hurdle you need to get over, it feels like, in almost any age, is you just have to, is this acceptable? Is this acceptable enough that we can make money doing it and get away with it without being put in jail? And they were, because it was sponsored by the government. So we've got this, these Royal African Company, that's the other thing. When they showed up, they weren't the first there. Sure, there was John Locke, who was a merchant ship captain, not the John Locke of the Enlightenment. I'm not talking about him. John Locke, a merchant ship captain, he's credited as being one of the first Englishmen to lead an expedition into Africa. And that was way back in 1554. Locke sailed to the Guinea coast, which is modern-day West Africa, primarily for trade, and his voyage aimed to acquire gold, ivory, pepper, but he also brought enslaved Africans back to England with him. And so that might be the first time the British took slaves from Africa and sold them back in England. But it didn't become a really big slave trade until later. But in those intervening years and throughout that time, other countries and nations had visited and built forts, such as the Dutch, who the British seemed to constantly be at odds with in this time. They had like three wars with the Dutch, the Anglo-Dutch Wars. So they stole some forts. They started to just take over forts that were there. You know, the British Navy was really starting to rise in power around this time, and they would throughout the 18th century as well. So that would sort of solidify their hold on the trade and the Gold Coast of Africa. But they also had this monopoly, right? So even if you were English, it's not like you could show up at this fort and, you know, you're just some merchant and, you know, hey, you think I could go into the country there and buy some slaves myself and head back and, you know, sell them? No, you could not, because the Royal African Company had a monopoly over it. That's what the monopoly means, is that you can't, just some other merchant can't show up and do their own dealings, which surely happened and surely caused conflicts all over the place, you know, and maybe some tribe that the Royal African Company starts dealing with to purchase their slaves from, maybe they're double dealing and dealing with other nations or just some private merchants, and it can get kind of messy, right? But so this RAC, eventually they had about 40 forts along the coastline of Africa, and so they were really getting well established in the area. And so these were just trading posts, so you'd used for a couple of reasons, either stop-offs for longer voyages. You know, they'd hold a lot of stockpile of food for traveling ships that are coming and going with slaves. They've got a lot going on at these forts, and they have to be well supplied. They'd have barracks, and they'd also have to have a lot of things to trade with the natives to buy these slaves. It's not like they're just giving them away. I mean, as a kid, I sort of like, in my head, I understood it as like, okay, well, white people showed up in Africa and they just started wandering around the woods and hunting down black people and rounding them up and taking them over to the United States where they would, like, you know, work in the fields and stuff. And that's kind of the gist of the slave trade as we understood it. But, I mean, it was more complicated than that, obviously. There were coastal tribes that would be dealt with, and they would actually help acquire slaves more inland. And so the slave trade would just, it wasn't just between the people acquiring the slaves in Africa and then trading them in the Americas. These slaves could trade several hands before they even left Africa. And then finally, the slaves would show up and be put on these boats, which, well, they'd show up at the forts, right? And they'd house them in these just god-awful prisons, you know? And then people are dying in the prisons, of course. And, you know, that's the cost of doing business. And they would let that would be somehow okay. And then they'd load them onto the boats. And, you know, those boats were probably the worst living conditions that you can imagine, right? You can't go anywhere. You're stuck on this boat and people are getting sick and dying all around you. It wouldn't even be, even being the white folks, the slavers themselves, I can't imagine that was a very good time on those boats. It had to be quite miserable being around death, no matter how crass or shitty of a person you are. There's no way that they did that with a smile on their face, unless they were all completely insane. You know, it's like they have to go down below deck. All right, who died today? Let's, hey, you scoop up your friend there. We need to throw him overboard. No Christian burial, nothing like that, of course. Just, you know, treating them as awful as you can imagine people being treated. But this area that they're in, Ghana, was a big source of the slaves, and because there's a lot of people around there, and there was this Ashanti Empire that was native around, that sort of grew around the same time. It was actually closer to the year 1700 when this Ashanti Empire would rise up. We'll actually talk more about them in the next episode, but there's all these clans and tribes, and during this time, there's these coastal tribes, and then there's the tribes inland, many, many miles inland, that eventually those tribes inland are more likely the ones that were going to end up as slaves, because they were going to get attacked by the coastal tribes that have support from the Europeans, and they're bringing their European guns in there, and they're trading for European guns. And so they've got this, you know, they show up, the British show up, and they start trading for some slaves. And they give these coastal tribes some guns, right? Then now these coastal tribes have a little bit more of an advantage. Now, to be fair, Ghana has had metalworking since like 1200 BC. And they're familiar with weapons because the Turks had come down, the Ottomans, and they had introduced them to firearms. So firearms were already there. They already knew about firearms. I thought that was interesting that I just don't know much about Ghana. And, you know, it certainly isn't just picturing people in grass skirts running around in the rainforest. That's not what we're looking at here. I think that's some kind of moral justification too, is that it was looked at as like, oh, well, these were just like these native tribes. They weren't very advanced socially or whatever. Yeah, no, they had their own social structure. They were advanced. They did have technology, just because it wasn't the same as Europeans or advanced, quote unquote, to the same level as the Europeans. That also somehow probably made it look like they were lesser than, but anyway, so this trade, I mean, they give these guys guns to trade, and it's only going to make it easier for them to get more slaves, right? Because now these coastal tribes will be able to get more powerful and be able to acquire, enslave their neighbors. And what a great way to get rid of your enemies if you are a coastal tribe, right? You can just say, oh man, we've got this garbage chute called the Royal African Company where we can just throw our enemies in it and they're going to just put them on a boat and send them across the ocean. We never have to look at them again. And so they don't realize what they're fully a part of. They don't know what's going on over the Americas. They might not realize that this is like, hey, this is the beginning of a 400-year just awful time for many generations of people. And so, I mean, these tribes in Africa are worried about what's present in front of them. I mean, it does take a pretty awful person to enslave anybody. I will say that. But, you know, I'm putting more of the, let's not even worry about blame. You know, it is what it is. It was horrible. And I think, so where were they going? Where did they put, they put them on the boat and then what? You know, they got these slaves. Well, this brings up sugar, the demand for sugar. It's so weird that the demand for sugar is, what drove so much of the slave trade. I do not think about sugar as being a evil thing, but the Caribbean, where all these sugar plantations were popping up, by the way, European colonists who basically just showed up and say, well, oh, there's people here, but you know what? They can work our fields, and guess what? We'll bring even more people in, and they can work the fields too. Just the crass, like, we own everything attitude that Europeans had at the time is just, it kind of reminds me of America. But anyway, it's this idea of trade now that we've got. There's going to be this idea of triangular trade between Europe, Africa, and the Americas. It's much more complicated than this little summary here, but this is an example how it might work, just to kind of get the idea of, you know, how the goods rotate and create trade in this region. So you've got like raw materials, lumber, ore, which might be sold, harvested from the colonies, and then sold to England. And these raw materials, maybe they'd be manufactured into goods that would be sold all over the place. But one of the, you know, a lot of them would be sold right back to the Americas or other places, you know, other countries. But some of those goods would make their way down to Africa as trade goods for slaves. And so they would, you know, they weren't just selling the coastal tribes guns. They were selling them all kinds of, you know, raw materials and manufactured goods, beads, there were metalware, metal cutlery, all kinds of things they were selling them. And so then they would trade those for slaves who would then be taken over to the Caribbean and the Americas, where they would do all the work to create more raw materials that were then sold elsewhere. You know, so this sort of a system is all, it's all run by slaves. It's all like powered by slaves, because without slaves, you don't have the raw materials that are then used to make the goods, to buy more slaves, to get the raw materials, to make the goods, to buy more slaves. And it's this went on for centuries, basically. And we're talking, you know, from the 1500s, basically. I'm not sure when the first, I should have probably looked this up, when the first slave landed in the U.S. I don't even think probably anybody knows that. But, you know, you're talking the probably 1600s, early 1600s, and then till, I'd say till the end of the Civil War. But we all know it went on longer than that through slavery just kept going on under a different name by basically putting black people under contracts that they could never get out of, just like sort of corporate slavery these days. And that brings up a kind of, I want to close on this a little bit, because it's like, I was looking up pictures of the RAC, the Royal African Company, and then I was just looking for some pictures and information about slavery in general, and I came across this world map, and it showed like countries that had slaves, and the most, you know, how much slavery they had. And I was like, oh, this must be like a historical map. And then I said, I reread the title of the image and it said current slavery around the world. And this was 2019. And for Africa is still horrible for slavery. It's kind of awful. All over the place, there is varying degrees of slavery. And that's what's interesting is like you look up, well, a lot of people have heard things about like, well, your iPhone is acquired by, mining rare minerals that are needed for cell phones. And that mining is being done by child labor and this and that. And somebody will go, well, that's the only job they could get. Like, oh, okay. That makes it okay. It's like, well, we're doing these kids working 18 hours a day. We're doing them a favor. Get fucked. People who say that, come on. I mean, and then there's the chocolate. I don't honestly know much about that, but I've heard that Hershey's or chocolate companies, there's chocolate companies out there that are very good at keeping the media out of places where they don't belong. And I've always worried about this, but think about this. Let's say I own the news and I'm the news guy, right? And I've got a giant advertiser named Schmershies. Schmershies has chocolate. Schmershies spends a lot of ad dollars on our news program. Like they do a lot of the advertising. They do a lot of ads. We go way back, you know, and you know, then we, I get a news reporter that comes up and says, listen, we've got the story about chocolate out of Africa by Schmershies. And it looks real bad. They're doing some really bad things in Africa. And, I'm 10,000 miles, not 10,000 miles away, but thousands of miles away over in the U.S. in some office building somewhere with air conditioning. And, that sounds like it's more of a local problem. Hershey's is just buying, Schmershies. It's just buying the chocolate from them. So they're the ones, you know, it's really a African problem and da 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 da. We don't need to cover that. Let's focus on other things. We don't need to be besmirching our great advertiser here. But if you don't think that is happening, not that specifically, but things like that, things where we're basically, you know, media is turning a blind eye because by turning a blind eye, they don't lose advertising. And that's the downside of news being privately owned, I guess. But I'm not saying it's a good, you know, you don't want a frickin' one world government, big brother news organization, you know, like the United Nation news organization, you know, that would certainly not be good, but, it is a difficult problem to deal with, but this slavery, my point is the slavery's not gone away. Slavery's never gone away. There's always been slavery. I don't want to say there'll always be slavery because that's pessimistic, but I have to point this out. I have to say something about it on here because I can't sit here in my air-conditioned house in the Midwest, where I buy chocolate, I buy clothing, I buy electronics, I buy things that I am aware of, that somewhere in the world, somebody is being indentured into producing. And it's really hard to reconcile in your own life. I even remember, I wasn't aware of this years ago, and since I've heard a lot more about it, but this was back in the late 2010s or, you know, probably 15 years ago. And I was talking to some guys, we were going to make a video game together and we didn't really know each other. We met online. We were going to make a video game together, but we'd get together and meet online, some Yahoo audio. I can't remember what program, it doesn't matter. But one of them was from Florida and he, you know, we didn't end up making the game because we just ended up bullshitting the whole time. Surprise, surprise. But he was talking about corporate slavery and how what happens was these illegal immigrants, you know, undocumented, whatever you want to say, I personally always just say, you know, if I lived in a third world country and I could make my family's life better by marching through shit to get to a first world country, I would certainly do that. So that's my position on that. If you're wondering where I stand on the border, you know, I mean, just look at it from other people's perspective. But what happens is these people will get these jobs at some plant, you know, fruit plantation, literally like a plantation to harvest fruit, and they need a place to stay. So they'll give them a place to stay, to live. But the rent and the cost of food to like pay them ends up being more than what they get paid. And they end up owing money to the landowners. And they're basically told, look, you got one or two options here, man. You can go back. We can ship you back and report you to the authorities, and you'll get sent back away from everybody. Or you can keep working for us to pay off your debts. And that's what this corporate slavery is. This is what this guy told me. And it found it out to be, obviously it was very true. I just was naive and didn't understand it at the time. But now understanding that even eating fruit or eating fruits and vegetables at your local supermarket, in the United States, unless you're, you know, getting your produce from like, unless you know where everything is sourced, you can't be sure that there isn't some corporate slavery involved in that. And what sucks about it is that there's no government regulation over that because they don't know, they quote unquote don't know about it. But, you know, it's everywhere, this slavery. And, you know, they say you hear about all the human trafficking, and this is the kind of things they're talking about, is you're being taking advantage of people, basically. I mean, there's different kinds of slavery. You know, sexual human trafficking is another thing. That's a form of slavery. It's not just the corporate slavery and the, you know, people getting paid nickels to sew shirts and soccer balls. I remember in the 90s, you grew up and, you know, your shirt would say, I remember it being a big deal. It was like Made in America was a big thing. And that just, the internet and buying stuff online, it just torpedoed that whole concept. And, you know, I'm pretty sure head to toe, I have no doubt that everything I'm wearing was made overseas. And I don't know to what level the conditions are that the people that made my clothing lived in. And so I guess that's my point, is that we can talk about historical slavery and look down upon it, but we should all take a close look at our lives presently and think about what kind of world we want to live in. Because I kind of think that the future versions, our future society is going to look down on us. I really do think that. Just as we look down on the slave owners that had chattel slavery. Sure, it might not be that. We don't have generational slavery in the United States. Not really. I mean, maybe somebody could make some argument that by keeping people economically depressed, that there is still kind of a generational slavery in that way. But I don't know if I'm making that. I'm not making that argument, but I'm open to hearing that argument. I'll say that. Anyway, that's the episode for today. Hope you've liked the more riffy version. I need to work on it, obviously. I have a bit of a stilted way of talking, and I need to be a little more smooth, a little more buttery, and try to make it flow a little better, you know? Yeah. So the next episode, we'll be talking about the Ashanti, which were called the Ashanti by the British, and just kind of understand their empire a little more, and might work backwards in time a little bit from there. I have an idea of where I want to go from Ghana onward, but I'm not sure. I won't know until I've completely done the research for next week's episode. Anyway, have a lovely week, and I will see you next time. Thank you for listening to Meridians.